some reason. We will start today with a work session for the introduction of committee bills. Senator Wortley, you...
Mr. Chair, I move the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills. Numbers 1372, 1585, 1587, and 1931. I believe members of the committee have the list with a brief explanation of each draft.
Thank you. Senator Gordon moves the introduction of committee bills, as she just read off. I won't repeat them. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. We will close that work session. And...
Mr. Chairman, we'll record that as assent with three members absent.
Okay.
Absent or excused.
Right, excuse.
Members, we now have a series of bills in front of us that are all brought to us by, I believe they're all brought to us by the Employment Department, if I remember right. So I'm assuming the Employment Department is here and willing to testify on these bills. So I think, Mr. Putman, is it okay if we open a combined public hearing on all seven, is it? Is that kosher by the rules this time around? I think it is.
Yes, sir. We'll make it kosher.
Okay. So we are opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 362, 395, 398, 399, 403, 430, and 414. I don't know if we need a sign-up sheet on all these, or if you already have one of those, or just ask Rolina to come up and...
There will be signed testimony in opposition to one of these bills that I'm aware of at this point.
Okay. Rolina, we'd like to come up and start in on, I guess, go through the list.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, or I guess afternoon, isn't it? And members of the committee, I'm Brilina Crosley, the Director for Oregon Employment Department. Each one of these bills that you'll be looking at affects various parts of programs, and so there are program staff that will be joining me at the table if you have technical questions that I can't answer. I'm assuming that you want me to start with Senate Bill 362, Mr. Chair?
That
can go
fine.
Right down the line? Okay. You should have testimony in front of you.
We've got a big book. Is that what you
That's it. And we actually did put them in bill order number, and then your staff, if you would like, can rip them apart and put them in your bill files, but so we wouldn't be each one handing them out separately. Senate Bill 362 is a bill that we're bringing forward to you to allow the Employment Department to accept federal funds called READ Act. READ Act is a special fund that the Department of Labor is making available to states, but they require that the state legislature authorizes the state agency, in this case the Employment Department, to accept those. This is a new distribution. Prior distributions that we received, and there's not been that many, but prior distributions, as you can see on the first page of my testimony, were allowed to be used for three purposes: payment of unemployment insurance benefits, administration of the state unemployment compensation laws, and establishment and maintenance of public employment offices. This distribution that they're going to be making and are making available to us can only be used to fund unemployment insurance program services. The governor's budget does anticipate these funds. They are in our budget request, and we actually are paying with for existing positions that we are using with these funds, because what the Department of Labor did was they decreased our regular allocations and then supplemented them through this different kind of funding. So in effect, they probably are not new dollars. They're probably just the same amount of dollars that would be coming in for the most part. In order to put Oregon employer tax money back to work in Oregon, though, we do have to be able to accept that, and for that reason, we are asking for you to support this bill. Any questions?
Well,
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Harper.
What are we going to do with these funds? I guess the replacement funds?
CR replacement funds, Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, and we run our administrative functions for unemployment insurance, paying benefits, collecting taxes, those kinds of things.
So we get a reduction in the premiums?
Those funds are a different type. These are the ones that you pay through the Internal Revenue Service and then comes back to us as administrative funds. They are not the funds that we collect in Oregon for benefit only.
Okay. I guess the obvious question becomes, what happens if we don't pass this bill?
Then we cannot accept the funds and there would be a decrease of staff availability to process claims.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I did take the opportunity to read the federal law. The instructions from the Department of Labor to their field offices use the words that states are required to pass this kind of legislation. In the past, the READ Act basically has not had this kind of funding in it, and this is a special deal, as I understand it, and they are prohibited from using these funds for benefits. They have to use them on administration. Whether the state has to pass it or not is, of course, up to the legislature, but that the feds, that's their instructions to the Employment Division.
Okay. Renee, didn't you say that you're currently getting some of these funds now?
We had distributions that were anticipated in the current biennium by the past legislature, and at that particular time we could purchase buildings, which we purchased a one-stop building in Eugene at the legislature's approval, and so we did use it for that purpose. But with these new funds, we can only use them for the purposes that we've been talking about, not purchasing the buildings.
Mr. Chair? Senator Corcoran?
Maybe I missed the beginning of your presentation, Relena, but did you explain why it's only 3 years? I mean, if this is an ongoing issue, why wouldn't we extend it out?
Mr. Chair and Senator Corcoran, I didn't cover that, but the READ Act requires a separate appropriation from Congress, and at this time, that's the only periods that they're covering, and it is a special thing. They don't do this all the time. The last time, besides these last 3 years that we've been receiving funds, it was a year since we had a recent distribution.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Good. I understand you just say that you could not use this to buy real estate? I think it says states may, among other uses, use these READ Act funds for purchasing real property for UC purposes.
Mr. Chair and Committee Administrator, that's the old language for the old distributions. The current law appropriation language does not allow us to use it for that purpose.
Okay. So you have an outdated federal tax that was
crucial.
I think my budget manager has a copy of the current language if you would like to see that.
I'm
Mr.
sure Mr.
Putman.
Putman would like to see that.
Okay. We'll later. Make sure that you get that.
Later.
That'll be the last question you ask.
Whether he knows it or not, he would like to see it now. Okay. Well, let's move on to the next bill, then.
Senate Bill 395. Donna Hunter will be joining me at the table. Mr. Chair and members, again, for the record, I'm Verlina Crosley, Employment Department Director. This particular bill deals with two issues. One, under current law, there is factors in state law that we look at when we look at independent contractors. The independent contractor bills have repeatedly come up during prior sessions, and at the end of last session, we agreed that we would go around the state and ask people to talk about whether the factor should be changed. We have done that. We've met in 5 places across the state, and we will be providing to you and the governor's office a report. Generally speaking, though, there was agreement, general agreement that the factors are encompassing and quite clear. The area that there tended to be, however, some general discussion about the need for clarification was that the law did not anticipate technology changes that have occurred. So in one portion of the bill, it would highlight that if a person is using websites in which to advertise and put forth their business, that that would be an appropriate means of meeting a test that requires showing that you are in business. We've currently used things like business cards, those kinds of things, and that would include more and would allow technology. The second area I'm going to turn over to Donna Hunter, and she will go through it with you.
Okay, in Section 2 of the bill, it changes ORS 657044, which was passed in the 1995 legislature to allow members of a closely held family corporation to elect to opt out of coverage. And in that, we had a list of family relationships that we deemed to be family held, but there are some basic relationships missing from that list, and we believed it was the legislature's intent to have a family be able to exclude the whole family. So it doesn't list spouses and domestic partners as members of the family. It lists grandchildren, but it doesn't list grandparents. And so the proposed change would add those particular relationships into it. And it was due to the Supreme Court decision on the Tanner case, which said that same-sex partners can't be discriminated against under the Constitution, that we believe that if spouses is added to this list of relationships, then domestic partners would need to be added too. That was the advice we had received from the Department of Justice. Also,
excuse me, Donna, did you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I am sorry.
Why don't you, can we shift those microphones a little bit so you can actually speak into the microphone? Thank you.
Thank you. Donna Hunter, I'm the tax manager for the Employment Department. Excuse me. Then in the...
Sure.
Senator Stark.
The Tanner case, is that a state or a federal case?
That was a state case, and that was determined by our Oregon Supreme Court. Also, the last change then is a proposal on line 30 on page number 2, and that is a clarification as to whether a family means more than one individual. And we again had received some informal discussion from the Department of Justice that family means family and that one individual is not a family. We had been allowing single individuals to opt out as closely held family corporations, but we do believe that there is a question about this, and we wanted to come back to the legislature to establish that clear intent. So this is a policy discussion that we are bringing before you with proposed language that we believe that based on DOJ, Department of Justice discussions, that an individual is not a family.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rodney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hunter, you indicated that five meetings were held around the state with regard to the policy. Or was that the
that was, yeah, I did.
I'm sorry.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, the meetings that we held around the state in, were to discuss the independent contractors and not the family-held corporation.
Okay. I missed your
Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The adding the website, a good idea. Is there any language do you think we could put in there that's more generic so we don't have to, when the next gizmo comes along, of which we don't know what it is, we don't have to revise the statute? Did you guys talk about that at all or think about that?
Gizmo's a good idea, Mr. Chair.
I understand it. I'd like that one. You know what I'm saying, so we don't have to keep revisiting this thing when the next piece of technology comes on.
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, I know we did talk with our staff and in discussions with the governor's office to allow technology generally. Website is what came up specifically. We could ask more generally for a term like electronic technology or something like that.
I would suggest that we try and find something that would
allow a little broader, a little longer down the road before that's changed.
We would be more than glad to talk to VHS about that.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I did want to come back to my question. I've collected my thoughts here. The five meetings that were held focused on the independent contractor piece of the policy. Where did those meetings take place, and who participated, and what was the thrust of the meeting? And then you also indicated that there's a report coming to the governor soon. When will that report
and to the legislature? In probably just a few weeks. We just finished one in Pendleton. We had one in Salem, Wilsonville, Eugene, Medford, and Pendleton. We were going to have one in Bend, but there was not enough people. There was like two or three people, and they indicated that they could attend one of the other ones, and they did do that.
And who participated?
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Senator Gourley, there were employers as well as union representatives. There were public employees, or people from school districts, and it seemed to me that there were elected officials. The Indian tribes, at least in a couple of them.
Mm-hmm. I think that covers it.
We have a full listing of the individuals. They did sign in, and we did the reports as we've gathered information in each site. We kept their comments separate from other people's. And then we took their names down and their mailing address. We send back those comments to make sure that we heard them right. And then we modify them based on their comments, or if there is a misunderstanding, we just put their comments in total, just the way they submitted them as part of the report. And we are just putting that together. Pendleton, we just finished, I'm thinking like last week or a week and a half ago, and those comments are being merged into that document, and we'll make that available to you.
How long before we see that document then?
I'm thinking probably 2 weeks.
Okay. I guess the obvious question would be, you mentioned a whole bunch of different stakeholder interest groups that were there, but you left out a key one in my element, and that was independent contractors.
Well,
were there no independent contractors attending these meetings?
There were people that represented independent contractors, and you'll see that as part of the testimony where they would like to have them at least treated as independent contractors.
And there were representatives too. We had a senator and a representative attend also in Eugene, I believe it was.
Okay, well, I will be anxiously looking to see that report, and as soon as you get it, can you get it to Mr. Putman, and he can distribute it out to the committee members?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? You have a question?
No. Nope. Do I look confused?
Yeah.
No. I'm wondering what I'm doing here on Friday afternoon when we decided not to have Friday hearings.
We didn't work.
Did the rules change?
Don't get me started.
I thought with the inauguration, it'd only be Democrats here anyway. But
you were hoping, huh?
Well, there's that. We get rid of some labor bills.
I guess down to Section 2, by your testimony, are you saying that you don't think the bill or the law as currently drafted that spouses were included? To me, it says same family as parents. I want to know if, in your opinion, spouses were not included in current law.
When we talked to Mr. Chair, when we talked to the Department of Justice, we have been interpreting it as such as, so that in our administrative rule, we did put in spouses. We were interpreting the law as reading as examples. And so that's why we included spouses, and we included stepchildren and grandparents in our rule. But they deemed it to be a somewhat ambiguous statute and felt that it needed to be clarified, and that perhaps our rule might be going beyond the law. And rather than asking for official advice that we would need to act upon at that time, we felt that coming back to the legislature for intent would be a better idea.
So another way to do it then would be, rather than create a longer laundry list that is going to be outdated again, and anticipating Senator Harper's concerns, if we put in the words "such as" and left the laundry list as it is, it would then be okay.
Mr. Chair, we would have to still clarify an administrative rule because it wouldn't be clear on its face, but we could do that through administrative rule.
Have you changed your administrative rule?
We have not.
So your administrative rule is still beyond the statute, and so if we change the statute to match your administrative rule, you probably wouldn't have to change your administrative rule.
We would have to still have a clarification, though, for a single family. In other words, a one person. We have been interpreting it as allowing them as well, and there's about 600 people that we have been allowing as a single family corporation when they're one person. And though that really does need clarification.
And that is if we change the law as your new sub two. If we do not change the law as your sub two here in this bill,
then it would be my belief that you would have to have intent on the record, and then through an administrative rule we could still allow that.
That a single person can be a family.
Correct.
Because the way you have it here, a single person cannot be a family.
Yeah. Right. So we brought that back because there was less clear intent on that particular case. So it really is to get a direction from the legislature.
The Department of Justice on that one was more adamant about the fact that as much as they could search any definition they could find, that a single individual did not meet the requirements of being a family.
Okay. Anyone else have a question? All right, let's move on to the next one. Oh, just a moment. Okay, go ahead. I see someone has signed up to testify, but it's on the next bill. So.
Okay.
Perfect.
Mr. Chair and members for the committee, again, I'm Verlina Crosley, Employment Department Director, and I have with me Rob Edwards, who works in our tax section. I'm going to ask him to go over the individual. There are two changes that this bill makes to help with accounts receivables collection for the agency, and I'll have him walk you through those two changes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Edwards. I am with the tax section of the Employment Department. We have stylized this bill as accounts receivable management, but it actually covers two completely separate areas. The first one is a combined notice of benefits overpayment. This is intended to streamline a quirk that we have now, where if someone receives an overpayment in benefits, they actually end up getting two separate notices, and those notices have to be separated by an amount of time, so that becomes very confusing to them. They'll receive one notice and think that kind of takes care of the problem, and then 20 days later they receive a second notice, and it doesn't seem clear what we're trying to do at that point. So what we'd like to do is combine those two notices into one envelope, basically, and give them all the information at the same time. The second part of the bill deals with a non-sufficient check penalty. This is a collection tool, an additional penalty that we'd like to add to encourage people not to give us NSF checks. The statute calls for the penalty to be assessed if someone gives us a bad check for the second time in a 3-year period. That way, if it's attributable to just a mistake or a one-time thing, they don't get the penalty. But if they give us a second check within that 3-year period that doesn't go through the bank, we would assess the penalty. They would have an opportunity to ask for a waiver of the penalty due to good cause. And if that waiver is denied, then they could ask for an appeal through our regular appeal process. This part of the statute mirrors what the Department of Revenue currently has for their NSF check penalty.
Mr. Harper, you have a question?
Yeah, my business, I can charge $15 and get away with it, but that's about it. I'm in the wrong business.
You should be in the government business.
I guess so.
I guess that kind of leads my question is there anything in the statute prohibiting you from charging what the rest of us in business can charge now?
Mr. Mr. Senator, or Senator Beyer, no. There is nothing in the statute that prohibit us from charging what other businesses can charge. I think.
Why don't you?
Senator, we just have not up to this point. We could, probably with an administrative rule.
So why do we need to pass a new law to give you authorization to charge penalties when you already have that authorization?
I think, Mr. Chair, it's to get clear authority from the legislature for the department. This would be a huge departure from prior action, and we do like to bring actions like this to the legislature to get your feedback.
So rather than write a separate law, then we could always just reference that you, wherever the statute, I don't know where the statute is, it gives the rest of the chance.
30.170, I think.
That we could always just put something that the Department of, or Employment Department, excuse me, has authority to collect fees pursuant to ...
If that it would be the policy of this committee, we could certainly live with that. We actually work, as you know, a lot with the employment, Department of Revenue. We share forms with that agency and a lot of information with that agency, and it was to put us on an even keel with an agency that has already been authorized. But if you would want to do it the other way, we'd be more than willing to accept that.
Another question on this area. I know that last session we had a bill dealing with delinquent accounts, and I don't remember exactly if your agency was in or out, and the way didn't it end up to be a kind of a trial or a pilot thing that we're going to have some agencies put out delinquent accounts to private collection agencies to see if we could increase the collection numbers. Now, was that something that your agency does now? Do you use private collection agencies to help bring in delinquent accounts?
Mr. Chair, no, we are not in that bill, and you would have to talk to someone else about the success of that. I have not been following that particular success factor, but we are not in that bill. There is current discussions with us and Department of Administrative Services about that piece, and we are looking at whether we can, and we will make that part of any discussion you would like to have.
So currently you do not use collection, the private agencies to try to collect delinquent accounts?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We do not.
How much do you have in delinquent back, you know, NS checks and stuff like that? How big of a burden? And I know last session we got a report that had all state agencies, and I don't know exactly where you were in that, if you were in that report or not.
Mr. Chair, I want to say that while we don't use private collection agencies, we do use the Department of Revenue when we charge off accounts and they are deemed uncollectible, so I want to make sure that you know that. But the other piece that that we are not clear about, and you heard this a lot last session, because we are a federally funded agency, there is a question about how you pay a collection company and whether or not we can actually assign an account and when we can assign an account. So those are the issues that we are looking at. As far as to the amounts, if Rob has those, I will have him cover them.
Mr. Chair, I do have some numbers on that. I will mention that we are part of the requirement, the reporting requirement, and we did report our collections and accounts receivable to the Secretary of State as required by that bill last session. Our accounts receivable balance as of June 30 of 2000 was $7.5 million, and that represents a decrease of $489,000 over the same date of a year prior. So, in fact, our accounts receivable have been decreasing slightly. I don't have any figures with me on the amounts due to overpayments, benefit overpayments. We can get those numbers for you if you want them.
By that you mean the amount you owe back?
No, I'm sorry, sir. Senator, Mr. Chair, it's the amount that we have overpaid benefit recipients.
We have two accounts receivables. One is for employer taxes, and the other is if benefits are paid when they should not have been. For example, you go through hearing, and then we have to collect back, or there's an error, and we collect back. There's two. There's a benefit receivables and then a tax collection receivable.
Do you use Department of Revenue for both of those accounts?
We use it for the benefit one and not the tax one. What they do is match on Social Security numbers, and they don't have the same type of situation for employer type accounts.
Okay. Anybody else want to jump in here?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, I'm just curious. Both you and Senator Harper talked about what you do in your business in terms of $15, I think you said, Senator Harper. Is there a limit to pursue this in civil court? I mean, if somebody writes you a non-sufficient fund check in your business, is $15 all you can get from them plus the money, or can you go to court and sue them for treble damages?
You can go. I believe the law is you can get $15 or three times the amount of the check, whichever is more.
Okay, so in essence, then this treble, what apparently revenue does already, Mr. Chair, then is available to citizens and small businesses and so forth.
Well, I don't know if it's exactly the same, but it's.
Right. I don't mean the same procedurally. We can't administratively go, collect on a check. I understand that you'd have to take it to the small claims court, but the treble damage is what I meant. You have the ability to do that.
Yeah, and there are some limitations to that, and I'm not sure what they are, but that procedure is available for private businesses.
But you'd have to go to court, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, there may be a clarification of the question that Senator Corcoran is asking on the second page of the testimony on this bill. At the bottom of page 2, there's a footnote 2.
This is testimony from...
Under ORS 30.701, anyone can charge a handling fee of up to $25 for a dishonored check. Anyone can also file an action to recover damages equal to triple the check amount, with a minimum of $100 and a maximum of $500 plus attorney's fees.
Yeah, so you're correct. Another thing to answer the question.
Okay.
So they provided it to us, and we didn't even get down that far on the page. I don't think they even knew they provided it to us.
We did, Mr. Chair. We also didn't want to... Senator Harper had said it was $15, and we thought it was $25, but we thought maybe he knew something that we didn't know.
Oh, I said, my market. I have to deal with the public, or they don't deal with me.
I see, Mr.
Unlike you guys.
What is it you sell, anyway?
Clean shirts.
Clean shirts?
Clean shirts.
Well, I guess it's better than the alternative.
That's right.
Okay, any other questions at this time?
We don't get much.
We have Jim Marquis signed up to testify. You can just stay there, but I think there's another chair, isn't there?
Sure.
Swing your microphone over for him. And
I will.
Just otherwise, you just have to get back up there. And Senator Corcoran indicates that he's in a hurry to get home, although I bet he's in a hurry to get down the street a ways.
Actually, if you want to know the real personal dirt, Mr. Chair, my wife scheduled she's trying to get me fit, so she scheduled a tennis date at 5 o'clock at the Eugene Swim and Tennis Club. So I'll probably violate the law going down
that
line.
You're going
to be lying. Marquis has indicated he would be very brief, though.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Corcoran, Mr. Marquis, on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association, a professional association of about 75 private sector collection agencies, our legislative committee has taken a position to oppose Senate Bill 398. It's probably not the biggest thing on our agenda this session, but I wanted to give you some information and share that with you. This bill would indeed allow the Employment Department to assess a penalty of treble damages against the maker of a dishonored check. ORS 30.701 currently provides for two types of penalties to a creditor for a dishonored check. A creditor, a person to whom a check has been written that is dishonored, can add $25 to the check and attempt to collect the check and the $25. If they fail to do so, under 30.701, they can proceed to issue
a notice to the debtor or to the maker of the check and provide that if the check is paid together with the penalty within 30 days, the issue goes away. They have to send that 30 days notice prior to filing a lawsuit, but in a lawsuit they can ask for and receive by a court damages in the amount of 3 times the face amount of the check. So this is available to anyone. It's available to private sector people. It's available to state agencies. The difference between that and what the department is asking for is they want to levy the treble damages before they issue a notice, a 30-day notice, demand letter, if you will, and then waive it if the person writes a letter. There's an appeal after the fact. Believe me, there are a lot of private sector collectors out there who would love to have the opportunity to do just that. Collect the treble damages, and if the, you know, if the guy doesn't like it, we'll waive it, you know, if we think the excuse is good or whatever. I think the point here is that the statute affords some amount of due process up front for the maker of the check. The this administrative penalty, I don't believe, provides any due process in front of the assessment of the treble damages. There's another problem that I see, and that is, and I think that this is perhaps a problem with the Department of Revenue statute as well. And by the way, I included a copy of 30.701, and I also included a copy of the 305.228, which is the statute that allows the Department of Revenue this ability to issue this administrative penalty of treble damages. I don't think in Senate Bill 398 that the department would be precluded from charging a treble damage administrative penalty and then later suing for another treble damages under 30.701. So I mean the way I, and I'm not a lawyer, but the way I read this, there's no provision in this bill that says they can't later sue and get treble damages again, which would make the penalty 6 times. That may be a little excessive. So the other point that I'd like to make is that one of the things that the Oregon Collectors Association has been attempting to do in this process, and with the help of Senator Beyer and others, we were able to pass legislation last session that encouraged better administration and the collection of debts by the state of Oregon. We've been working very closely with Department of Administrative Services, and Mike Greenfield has been great to work with. And in trying to develop some statewide standards in the collection of debts and trying to bring about better management of receivables generally, part of the problem I think that exists with receivables in the state of Oregon, and Matt Markey's in the back of the room, and he started this process with an inventory that he did of all debts owed to the state 3 years ago, and he came up with a grand total of $1.7 billion in delinquent accounts. And we passed this bill last session that requires people to report to the legislative fiscal office so that this can become part of your budgeting process in managing these receivables. And I know that Mike Greenfield and the Department of Administrative Services, while I don't want to speak for them, are very concerned about beginning to manage these at the front end and looking at statewide procedures and how to do so. We get state agencies coming into the legislature with a problem that exists in their agency, and they want you to solve that problem for them. I would submit to you, Department of Transportation probably gets 3 or 4 times the number of NSF checks that the Employment Department does. Why wouldn't you think about granting them that authority if it's so good for the Employment Department or for the Department of Revenue? Well, because they didn't ask. Because they didn't come here and ask. And I guess what I'd like you to think about is to look at this a little more globally and think about some of the ramifications for the state of Oregon and for the people that do business with the state of Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Jim, now let me get this straight. You're not asking us to change 30.701 to equal these regulations so it's equal across the board.
I think the relating clause is wrong, but I'd love to, but no.
No.
So what you're saying and what Mr. Putman has just told me is that the Department of Transportation statutes already point them to 30.701.
Well, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Apparently you disagree.
No. What I would say is, Mr. Chair, that the Department of Transportation has an administrative rule that says, their administrative rule I actually looked up because the Employment Department gave me a series of administrative rules that said, and they said, well, we're kind of just asking for what all these other agencies did by rule. Well, nobody did by rule what they're attempting to do here. That administrative rule issued by or promulgated by Department of Transportation says that they will, on every bad check, charge a fee, the maximum fee allowed by 30.701 sub 5, which is the $25.
Okay.
And if they want treble damages, they sue somebody and get a court to adjudicate that after they send them a 30-day notice and give them a chance to pay the check off, just like a private sector creditor would.
Okay. Harper.
So I guess that would be my question for the committee is, why would we have in the state different procedures for NSF when all of us all use 30 series?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, I couldn't agree more.
You got a relating clause here?
Mr. Chair. I guess it would beg the question also of why revenue does it that way.
Why is it different?
I don't know that there's anybody from revenue here, but it sort of begs that question. I mean, if they have the prerogative to do it that way, I mean, I can see sort of functionally how it works much smoother, but I see Mr. Marquis's argument that it eliminates some due process, and that would seem to be problematic.
I think I can answer that, why they do it that way, because we said they should.
Right.
Mr. Chair, if I could, there's one more reason. I missed it. I mean, I've been representing the Collectors Association for 25 years, and that bill came through this process when I was here, and I don't remember it, frankly. I mean, it just went by me, so.
That's your answer. Marquis, proud fault.
Yeah.
Marquis, okay.
Not doing my job.
Another question, Jim, while you're there. Do you have the aging of those accounts? You said you had 7.5 million in delinquent accounts. I mean, what's it take to get on that list? 30 days, 90 days, 60 days, a year?
Mr. Chair, you're on that list after. Not you personally, Mr. Chair.
And
the generic you, Mr. Chair.
Well, the farm workers get them.
After 30 days.
Mr. Chair, if I might indulge the committee one more moment. I think if you looked at the reports given to the Legislative Fiscal Office, you would find the Employment Department's total receivables, taxes, overpayments, and others, exceeding $30 million, not 7.5. And I can tell you that the department feels that they're exempt from the law, from 3509 that was passed last session, because it has a provision that says you're not under it if you're prohibited by federal law. And the people in the department that I talked to said that they're prohibited by the Social Security Act, which says basically inherently governmental functions must be performed by merit employees, meaning state employees. I can tell you that the Department of Labor, when I talked to them, the U.S. Department of Labor felt there was no problem in the assignment of accounts to private collection agencies. The state of Washington currently, their Department of Labor, Employment Department, assigns accounts to private collection agencies, the state of Minnesota and several other states. So just to let you know, there is a difference of opinion as to whether they're under that bill or not.
Are we going to see a copy of that report that's going to be, or is that just, is that possible, Jim, for you to make that report up? Do you have it up to date? I mean, I know 2 years ago when we started talking about 3509, we had a report of all the state agencies. Has that been updated at all?
Well, Mr. Chair, we're not, our bill, and Matt should be up here, it was his bill, he did it, but it required state agencies to report to legislative fiscal if they could. There were some state agencies that were unable to report this year because they didn't just didn't have the information. But of those that reported, Legislative Fiscal has prepared a report, and that should be available to you. I can talk to them about maybe making that available. Or
check with them and see if we can get that report.
But it would be Legislative Fiscal's report, not ours, so we're kind of out of that business now.
You don't
want
to do it again?
I don't want to do it again. Thank you.
Okay, history and error. Are we going to get into this session and receive it with again?
Well, I hope we can take a look at that report and see what good the bill we did, if any, and compare it to what it was 2 years ago and see if we need to make some refinements.
Mr. Chair, I would tell you that for the most part, the Department of Administrative Services and many, many state agencies are developing, there are contracts that have been let. Collection. There are many, many accounts being turned to private collection agencies, and several of our members are working very closely with many state agencies in the collection of these debts. And frankly, I think the system's working pretty well overall. I mean, I really think Department of Administrative Services has really been on top of this. I think they're doing a great job in the implementation.
$7.5 million or $30 million seems to be okay.
I'm not, Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, I'm not saying that at all, but what I'm saying is that you have to start somewhere, and I'm saying that I think we're at the point where we're going to start making some headway here.
Let's make a note of this. Senator Harper, do you want an update from an overview?
Roger.
I remember that.
Why do you keep calling him Roger?
Keeps answering.
It's like the movie
Mr. Mark P. for the record. Your testimony has been against Section 2 and 3 of the bill. Do you have any opposition to Section 1?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Putnam, absolutely not. I don't care less.
Thank you very much. Anything else on this bill? Thank you, Mr. Marquis, for bringing some of the issues forward.
Thank you. Let's
jump to the next one. So,
yep.
Senator Parkman is quite too late for his tennis game.
It is a lot of money, but, you know, you have to look at it in the scheme of how much money goes through the process. Money goes through your process in a year?
Well, on the benefit side, depending on what type of year we're looking at, somewhere between $400 and $500 million on the benefit side. And on the tax side, well, at least that amount, because we have to collect to cover the benefits. So it's a lot of money.
As a percent, so it's less than 1%.
That is $30 million.
Yeah, I understand. You guys are going to be looking for dollars under couches by the time we're done with this session.
Anyway. You bet.
Just reduce
shake your pockets out.
$7 million.
Well, if
Senate Bill 399.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Berlina Crosley, Director for the Oregon Employment Department. John Walton, my legislative coordinator, has joined me at the table for questions that you may have. Senate Bill 399 is a bill that, again, we put in at the request of the Attorney General's office. When we were going through review of our laws and administrative rules, it was raised to our attention that there was not overt authority. We've been using implicit authority for contracting. Department of Human Services, when we were a part of them as a division, we had contracting authority through the department, but it was not made as clear, although this bill is only to clarify that we have the authority that is discussed to actually enter into contracts to provide service as well as to receive services. So the bill really doesn't change anything, but there was a case that the Attorney General's office brought to our attention that it would be better to have in statute that there was clear authority for the types of contracts that we enter into. That's the first thing. The second thing that we tried to clarify in the bill is that under the Workforce Investment Act, we did make some references, as you can see on page 2 and 3 of the bill, that talk about entering into agreements with workforce investment partners, which can include other states, government, state agencies, units of local government, intergovernmental entities, community colleges, et cetera, because that is, in effect, what we're doing through memorandums of understanding that were not anticipated at the beginning of the legislation. When even you have authorization to enter into contracts, the department, the employment department, did not enter into memorandums of understanding like we were required to do under federal law. So they felt that it was a good thing to clarify in state law that that authority is there as well. And then under federal law, we are required to sign confidentiality agreements where we are going against our wage records to see what types of work people are doing and how quickly they're getting back to work. And so in Section 4, subsection 3, it does clarify, and again, we are doing this as well, but it does clarify that we are, as long as we are authorized under federal law and regulations, that we can enter into confidentiality agreements for performance measurements with other providers of service under the Workforce Investment Act. So this is a clarification bill. If it doesn't pass, I will still be able to, but it does put more overt authority for those people who look for it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
The only question I have, Berlina, is in Section 1, Sub 8, and Section 2, Sub 8, it lists the entities with whom you can do the states, governments, public bodies, or persons. What's your understanding of the word persons? Does that, is that limited to public persons?
Chair Beyer, Senator Corcoran, our understanding is that the statutes in another part and the AG's office have a definition for the term persons, and they are using that as a very inclusive term. It would cover individuals and other entities. So they've inserted, Ledge Council has also inserted that term persons, which has a particular meaning for them.
But under federal law, we are only allowed for certain purposes to provide information to public entities, merit service staff, et cetera. They cannot be public, general public individuals. So if you're a private company, for example, and you ask us for individual information and you were providing service under the Workforce Investment Act, you would not get that information because federal law would not allow it, as we have been told.
Mr. Chair, so just to be real clear then, mm-hmm. just to get it on the record, it is, in essence, public, not private.
If I may, Chair Beyer, Senator Corcoran, the authority that's in the subsection 8 that you were looking at in sections 1 and 2 of the bill, that's intended to be more of the broad authority that says for the department to be able to carry out its functions, we may end up contracting with a number of different entities.
And it could be private, for example, personal services, contracts, et cetera. So in that instance, you are talking about individuals that are part of private and public. But as far as the confidentiality agreements where we'd be sharing information as we understand it, it would not be beyond what is authorized by federal law. And as we understand it now, it does not include private individuals.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just one last follow-up. Then.
Go ahead.
This doesn't, it's your analysis then that this doesn't expand any rights you have now. It simply clarifies it.
Absolutely, and I've tried to make that highlighted in my testimony, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Corcoran. I do have one other piece in Section 3, and I'll let John talk about that.
Section 3 of the bill also includes a slight change to the property purchase requirement. This agency has in current statute a requirement that when it acquires a field office as part of our network of field offices or any other property purchase like that, there is a requirement for the governor's signature. Now, as you may know, to go through any procedure like that, we work through DAS facilities and through their contracting processes. We work closely with the Department of Administrative Services and the governor's office so that they would know about those contracts ahead of time. So we've got the governor's office in the loop. What this would do would be to say that the governor doesn't need to be there on the spot at the very end when we're signing a property purchase. My understanding is that when that happened in the most recent instance for the department, that the governor was not available at the time to sign the agreement.
And could not delegate the authority, Mr. Chair.
What did you do?
We had to wait, and it could have been very problematic.
Hopefully it'd be problematic.
Because sometimes you only have a certain amount of time to close the deal and still live within the authorization that we were giving from the emergency board.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Worthley.
What was the deal?
Eugene Field office.
Yeah, it was our Eugene Field office where we were buying it, and I can't remember exactly all the details because my business services people brought it to me, but the governor was not available, and we had things that were going through on a time track, and we had only a certain amount of time to respond, and we did respond in time, but it was fortuitous that we got to do that. Unfortunately, my business manager has retired, and I don't have the full facts of that, but it was enough to get the attention of DAS, Department of Administrative Services, in my office to come to the legislature because they did agree with that. You can see in Section 3, we still have to go through the approval of the Department of Administrative Services, which is the arm of the governor, to get approvals. And generally, as I understand it, that has been delegated. They can delegate the signing. In this particular instance, they tried to do that. The AG's office said that they could not and had to wait for the governor's signature.
Mr. Chair, if I could just finish with a follow-up. Thank you. In your written testimony, in that Section 3 paragraph, there's a sentence that's not quite complete, and I just want to make sure that I understand what your complete thought was meant to be. On the fifth line, the sentence begins, "In some cases, properties are best purchased." Period.
I think the point there that we were trying to make, and I, in rereading it, it's not quite as clear. A lot of our offices are leased, and in some cases, though, that we do purchase them. And we have probably, I think, between 10 and 12 right around that we own, and it's just saying when it is best that we purchase them, then we do enter into purchase agreements, and in that instance, we would like to not have to get the governor's signature. And if he could then delegate to the Department of Administrative Services, that would be the appropriate thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do I understand from your testimony that different agencies have different rules and requirements on purchase?
Correct.
Some require government signature, some don't?
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, that's our understanding.
That's pretty screwy. How do we get that?
Could you provide us with a list of the different agencies and what their different procedures are?
I know that we know some of them. I don't know that we know all of them, but I know state police, for example, and corrections are different.
Yes, Chair Byer, Senator Harper, we'd be glad to provide that list for you. It's our understanding that it would be things like corrections where they have high-profile property purchases like a siting of a prison or some of the other properties for the state police as well.
Are you aware of the statute that regulates that, or is there one, or are you aware where those rules come from?
I am not.
Chair Byer, Senator Harper, it is in statute, and I'd be glad to pull those references for you. I don't have them at hand, but I'd be happy to provide those.
Something, and we'll give them to the rest of us. Well,
certainly.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Is the statute in question the one that's referenced in your testimony?
The 279?
Yes, or are we talking about something else?
I believe the question is for other state agencies, are they all treated the same? Is there a uniform standard that we should be looking at to conform this state agency with the rest of the state agencies, or are there a mismatch all across the board? I guess that's my question.
Yeah, you'd have to look further than just 279, I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Gorley, because, in fact, the language that we're trying to change is not in 279. It is in our 657 chapter. The other thing that I would like to point out, Mr. Putman asked staff if I understood that it was not clear to him whether we were intending to get out from under the Department of Administrative Services contracting authority when we would have overt authority for contracts. It is not our desire to do that, and in asking our Attorney General's office to make that more clear, they had suggested if the legislature wanted to that they could put comma and then add the chapter reference that requires us to have approvals through the Department of Administrative Services, and we're certainly okay with that. It was not intended to get out from under their approvals.
Do you have amendment language?
We can, excuse me.
Actually, I'm okay with the language as it stands.
Okay.
I didn't mean to raise that as a
conflict.
That big an issue.
Okay.
It sounds like there maybe is an issue there.
Well, I think we need to look at consistency across the way. Right. So I'll take care of this.
I think it's on with, if I'm not mistaken, two different sections of the bill again, though. Is that correct? You're talking no longer.
Yeah, one, we're talking the general contracting authority rather than the governor's signature, correct, Mr. Chair?
Okay.
But we'd be more than glad if there is an issue there at all that we would want to clarify. That is no problem. And the attorney general.
In all honesty, I have to revisit with Mr. Walton what it is I said that caused him to believe I felt that way. And if he convinces me I really did feel that way, I'll be glad to run it down further.
We just want to be responsive to areas of concern.
You got
to
tell me what I think.
That's a form of job security I've not seen yet in this building. Tell me what I thought I said.
Yeah. I think that's probably a good idea. We may want to have Dask come talk to us about this bill, or maybe that would be the people to go to find out what other agencies have to do before they can purchase property.
They certainly, Mr. Chair, would have more knowledge in that area than we do. It only came up for us in the one instance that recently in my, and it's probably come up before, but since my tenure, and we were asked to raise them.
Maybe we can get Dask to come down.
Yeah. I'll be glad to get Dask to come in here. I'd be amazed if any agency can sign for real property or for leases, for that matter, without Dask approval ahead of time. Maybe somebody has that authority, but I don't know who it would be.
Yeah,
Department of Corrections can do anything they want.
I'm sorry?
No.
Okay.
Anything else on Senate Bill, whatever it was we were just on?
399.
Okay, moving to the next one. Senator Corcoran's getting nervous over there. He's going fast all the time down that freeway.
I'm doing fine, buddy, although I do have a suggestion.
Yes, sir.
To make, and that is that this nice little book that you guys did is pain in the neck because we generally like to keep the testimony in the bill file with the bill. So.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Senator Corcoran, before you came in, I said we put it here so we could flip through our testimony and then your people could rip it apart and put it in your bill files if you would so desire. But if you would like to see it a different way next time, we'd be more than
happy. Yeah, my staff just graduated from OSU, so I don't know if she could handle this.
Thank you.
Senator Corcoran, you could do like I am and be destroying the book as we speak.
That's
and then
exactly.
We'll pick them up afterwards.
Leave the binder because I've got an office full of empty binders.
Yeah.
Already.
And we often come around and pick them up, too.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and send the 403.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Berlina Crosley, Director of the Oregon Employment Department. Steve Pegger has joined me at the table. This particular bill allows dismissal of requests for hearing on claim for unemployment benefits under certain circumstances, and I will let him explain what the bill does.
It has been a long stand, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Steve Tager. I'm the presiding hearing officer for the employment section of the Central Hearings Panel. And it has been a long-standing practice of the hearing section within the department to dismiss requests for hearings when a party indicates that they want to withdraw the request or they fail to appear at the hearing or there's been a subsequent decision issued by the department that resolves the issue on which the request for hearing was made. The department, there is no express authority in our statutes to do that kind of a dismissal. The department has always considered it to be part of the inherent authority from our delegation of authority from the legislature to hold a hearing on an issue or controversy that if there is no longer a hearing or controversy, a party that wishes to pursue the proceeding, that we ought then to be able to dismiss that case without having to do anything more. And pursuant to that understanding, we have had an administrative rule in place since 1976 providing for the dismissal of requests for hearing under the circumstances that are described in the bill. I might say in the absence of any authority to dismiss a case, what we would have to do would be to have the hearing officer schedule a hearing, open the record, receive testimony from the party that I want to withdraw my request for hearing, then close the record, and the hearing officer would have to write and issue a decision based on the record at hearing. That adds a tremendous amount of needless cost to the system and clogs up our hearings docket with unnecessary hearings that results in delaying hearings for parties that actually have a case or controversy that they want to pursue. The reason this has come as an issue is we had one of our cases recently appealed to the Court of Appeals, in which the appellant raised as an assignment of error that they felt the department's dismissal rule went beyond our delegation of authority from the legislature. And although the Court of Appeals decided that case on other grounds, it did highlight the issue for us, and we are coming to the legislature basically to enact into law this administrative rule that we've had for many, many years to make it clear that we do have the authority to dismiss cases under the circumstances that are described and set forth in the amendment.
You know, this gets back to a problem. This is my third session being here, and every session we have a state agency coming forward asking the legislature to pass laws that codifies their rules that go beyond the laws. And it seems like someplace something is going backwards here, because state agencies are only supposed to implement rules that they're allowed to implement. They're not supposed to make rules and then come to the legislature and ask us to okay a rule you've already made. The process is broken and it's working backwards.
Mr. Chair, I respectfully disagree. I mean, I think that this came to light as a result of a court ruling. And so I think that it's perfectly reasonable to do this. But I did have one question, and that is, just to get on the record, that there's no intention here to expand or change any behavior that you currently exhibit in the hearings process.
Mr. Chair and Senator Corcoran, that's exactly right.
Senator Corcoran, I understand that. I'm not speaking about this one in particular, but
right.
I have sat in every committee for, I don't know how, and I'm just using this moment to vent a frustration. I'm getting tired right. of state agencies right. bringing bills forward, asking the legislature to codify rules because they went beyond their statutory authority to make a rule, and now they have to come ask to give the blessing of that rule. The process is broken. How would we fix the entire process?
And term limits.
That does it, huh?
Yeah.
I guess then we won't remember that 2 years ago that you did the same thing.
That's right.
It won't be a problem because you won't know about
right.
it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, too, having worked for four different departments in administrative rules, what you have sometimes are intent that is not always on the record. And when you're working with legislators in trying to put forth administrative rules, there's often administrative rule committees that we put together that even include legislators that were there at the time. But over time, that history is lost, and someone brings a case forward and say it was not clear on the record that certain things were intended. And that sometimes then means that agencies come back and say, okay, now we need more overt authority because a case has raised the need for that to be brought to the legislature's attention. I have personally, and matter of fact, we had bills last session that we involved legislators in, but most of that, you know, has been then delegated to the department, and most of that is not on the legislative record. It is outside of those discussions.
So if this bill goes away quietly, you tell me now, you are going to change your administrative rules, or are you going to continue doing business as usual?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, our rule has not been ruled beyond a statutory authority. It was raised as an argument in this appellate case, but the court did not decide that issue and did not say that our rule is beyond the delegation of authority. But because it was raised, and we have gone back and reexamined the statutes and rules, we agree that there is not express authority to dismiss. So, and it's very, very important to us that we have that authority, because we do believe that it would add significant costs to our hearings process, costs that we don't believe are necessary. So we just want to make sure that we have that authority.
So if, Mr. Chair, you say that we would change the rule, we would not, but if there was a case, and there certainly is a chance since it's been raised that people will look for a case, it could be decided that we do not have that, we would have to amend our rule, and the situations that Steve talked about would happen.
But in the meantime, it's been working for 25 years, so if we do nothing, it will continue to work for as long as we... Who knows?
Mr. Chair, there's no guarantee one way or the other.
Okay. Any other questions?
Feel better?
Yeah.
That hearing officer's pretty glad to be leaving.
I warned everybody, I get really grumpy between the hours of 3 and 5.
Well, why are you having committee then? I got a simple solution.
Because that's when the esteemed Senate President said we were going to have committee.
I see.
Senate Bill 430.
Okay.
414, is that the order we're going in?
Well,
yes, Senate Bill 414.
I'm sorry. I put that on last. 430 is
irrelevant. Isn't 430 was next one in your book, isn't it?
We can go Senate Bill 430, that's fine.
430. Yeah. That's
okay.
The next one I'm going to
describe. Very flexible, adaptable department fair.
Actually, Senate Bill 414, which we're not hearing right this minute, and Senate Bill 430 go hand in hand in a discussion.
We're hearing them all at the same time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Senate Bill 430 actually would expand a type of training opportunity for individuals that are on and receiving unemployment insurance. Let me explain a little bit. Many years ago in the early 1990s, we had a program called what we called vocational unemployment insurance. And during the early 90s, the laws were changed to more focus that particular law on dislocated workers, which in fact was a decrease in the number of people who would be under this opportunity. And let me explain. If certain people are in approved training, currently dislocated workers, they do not have to be available and actively seeking work. They can stay in training. It is believed by the legislature that it is a good thing for them to get new skills to be eligible for demand-type occupations, not just in the occupational area for which they have qualified for, because maybe those are declining and will no longer be in existence. What this particular bill allows us to do, and we are raising it to the legislature, we have had employers that are saying that they cannot find trained workers and that they need an available workforce that is more trained. So we felt that we would bring to the legislature, after discussing this with our advisory council and other employer groups, to raise to the legislature an opportunity, we think, to allow more people to be in training and to take advantage of this beyond dislocated workers. What we would allow is people that are eligible for unemployment insurance that would be eligible to receive benefits. They would not be disqualified for receiving benefits if they were in an approved training. We're calling it a skill gap unemployment insurance program, and we would limit the amount on that particular program to $7 million, which would be an amount that would not raise taxes for employers, which was one of our promises to the legislature, that we would not bring forth a legislative concept that would increase taxes. I have to say that if you didn't do it, it wouldn't decrease it either, because there is a swing in the actual tax tables that do not put you in or another tax schedule. It is within that range, is what I'm saying. So the first part of the bill actually talks about people that would be eligible, and then moves it beyond the dislocated worker training. It does not change the dislocated worker part of it. It would still allow that, and the $7 million cap would not apply to the dislocated worker. It would still operate like it's been operating. The other piece of the legislation is another area that employers have brought to us. And, you know, employers are not in universal, I just need to say, in universal agreement on this, but there are those that have asked to bring to the attention of the legislature a piece. If you are a part-time worker and you're going to school, we currently will not allow you to get unemployment insurance benefits because you have to be available and actively seeking full-time work for any shift. The last sections of the bills would allow, if you are a part-time worker and you are in school, you would choose your shift. So let's say, for example, I was in school during the day, but I was available for a night shift. I would still be eligible for unemployment insurance if I was laid off from that night shift. Same way, if I'd been going to school at night, then I would be eligible if I was available for the day shift. So I think you get that. And that particular part of the bill has a $3 million cost to it, around $2.7 million. During the 2001-03 biennium, and as I said, none of that amount either. There's about a $10 million that we are within the range, and these are two areas that we thought we would bring to the attention of the legislature. This, we believe, fits with the legislature's and the governor's belief that we should be helping move people up the continuum, and we would have my research section work with employers, which we currently do, to identify demand occupation and demand skills for which they could be in training for purposes of this bill.
Thank you. First question that comes to my mind is, if $10 million one way or another won't put us out of that range to where we can get a lower work UI rate, how big is that range?
That range right now is, when we put this in, was $10 million. That is the range. And we will be updating that, Mr. Chair, as with each one of the forecasts that the state economist puts out. We can tell because it's basically a projection of the types of benefits that would be paid out and how large the trust fund should be, and then therefore the taxes assessed. So it does change based on the economic forecast. But when we put
what you're saying is that currently, if you did this and raised the benefits up to $10 million. It won't raise taxes this time, but it's guaranteed that it will not lower them when the next forecast comes out also.
I don't think you could say. I think you could say the first. I don't think you can say the latter.
Well, if we're authorizing an additional $10 million to be spent, that means that we'd have to get the forecast would have to shift $20 million instead of $10 million in order to get a lower in rates.
That works, right. Frank, you want to come and join us? Frank works with actuarial and working more with the trust fund, and I think I'd be better served to have him answer that question.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Frank Ritchie. I am manager of unemployment insurance programs and analysis for the Employment Department. As I understood the question, I think you're right on. If an economic forecast were to say that that amount that we need to have in there to avoid raising taxes were to move down from 10 to 5, then having spent this would, of course, mean that we do that. But as Director Crosley mentioned, our plan is to continue to update those forecasts each time we get updated from the state economists so that we can keep you apprised of the numbers.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Senator Perkins?
I just think this is an excellent idea. I mean, the lack of flexibility for some of these dislocated workers going back into training, which would actually, you know, they don't become net taxpayers in the system until a family of four is earning somewhere around $35,000 a year. And so, and clearly all the evidence that we've been shown at that high-tech conference, for instance, through the Department of Economic Development, through the Oregon Progress Board, is these dramatic, as you well know, these dramatic shifts from natural resource to high-tech, for instance, have truly happened. And whatever we can do to help with the training part of it, I think, is laudable. And I understand the concerns about the unemployment insurance issue for an employer. but I would submit that there are costs, indirect costs, that come from not having a trained workforce and having to import that labor as well.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gorbachev.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate Senator Corcoran's comments and would just like to follow that trail. The skills gap training unemployment insurance program that would be implemented in the bill fits with our Oregon Economic and Community Development Strategy, which is to provide supports to people in rural and urban distressed communities who need opportunities to gain training and skills, but at the same time, we're providing a cushion, if you will, a cushion of income to support that. So this particular strategy makes good sense to me.
The Workforce Investment Board that we have in the state, have they looked at this concept?
Mr. Chair, I know that many of them have. The chair of that committee is on our advisory council and is in support of the bill. I think there may even be testimony from her. As far as all the members, I can't speak to that.
Senator Harper, I believe a member of this committee serves on that board.
But I've been remiss in my duties, so I couldn't tell you. Yeah.
Okay, any other questions? What is it?
That this is a definition of dislocated worker that's supported by new language.
Okay, I'm just asking what the repealed statute says in the bill.
One thing that you should also know, because at the end of the bill it talks about that certain portions of the bill would be effective on such and such a date. What that language is intended to do, that if, since it's a pilot program and we will see how beneficial this would be, because we would not ask you to buy into this and keep it going if, in fact, it did not move people up a continuum. If, in fact, the legislature did not reauthorize once the money would go, then the old language would just revert, which would apply to just the dislocated workers.
The amendments to, you're speaking of Section 13.
Mm-hmm.
The amendments to these ORS chapters by Sections 9 through 12 of this act become operative on January 1st, 2006.
Right. What they did is take the dislocated worker part out and rewrote it into a different part of the bill. And then what happens if the first part goes away, which is the skill gap UI goes away, then the old language reverts. And that's what Legislative Council has told us.
But I don't understand, and just help me understand it. Why would it go away?
If the $7 million was gone, we are putting this in as a pilot. And if it then is, there's no dollars to administer the program, then we go back to the old dislocated worker program, because we would not have funds. It's limited to the $7 million. So we would go back to just the dislocated worker program, not the skills gap UI.
Mr. Putman, we're going to have to get Legislative Council here to...
Yeah, this is the thing. Just seemed awkward. I hear what you're saying.
I felt it was awkward and was asking right before we came over here what this did, but that's my understanding is that they're trying...
Yeah.
The way they've crafted it is that if the skill gap UI program did go away, that we will revert to existing chapters, and this is the way it was drafted.
And I understand that. My concern is, how can a legislative program go away by administrative action? So I'm sure that's settled.
I don't think it would go away. I'm not understanding the administrative action.
You're going to get Legislative Council here to explain. This is the same way that, the similar to the way they draft workers' comp laws. And everyone knows that they've never dealt with that. It's very...
Just to follow up on that, $10 million is in your current governor's budget.
This is anticipated in our discussions with the governor, yes. The actual bill, which I said, if it doesn't have like a legislative policy package, if you will, it doesn't need that. But it is anticipated in the revenue that's in our budget currently.
I'm going to need help, not with the concept, but with the technology of the drafting.
Sure. Me too, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let's move on to our last bill. So Senator Corcoran has a somewhat of a chance to only be an hour late to his team. Mm-hmm.
That's okay. It is a form of exercise.
Down there.
Senate Bill 414.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I have been director for a few years now, and one of the things that we have made a big part of our service delivery is trying to get people back to work quicker to suitable work if they're on unemployment insurance. And my staff have all had goals, and they have had memos repeatedly on the importance of claimant reemployment and quicker movement into suitable jobs. In discussing how we can make this to come to the attention of the people who actually file for claims and to let them know that there is a work search help in the employment department, and that unemployment insurance is a way of providing the state to provide a type of income, replacement income, that is not the same amount as they were getting when they were working, but when they are unemployed through no fault of their own, that they would have some amount of income that would give them the security, if you will, in their mind, that they have some income coming in that they can then look for work, and that they should be looking for suitable work quickly. What we are asking in this particular bill, Senate Bill 414, and I forgot, I'm Selena Crosley, for the record, Employment Department Director. What we are asking is that the legislature join us in authorizing and rename the unemployment insurance program to reemployment insurance. I have talked to employer groups and my staff, my deputy director, and I have gone around, and by this time we have talked to almost everyone in my agency about this concept. They believe that it is a more positive word, and it does then imply that there is help from the department and partners around the state to focus on reemployment rather than unemployment. As one staff said to me, you don't go out and buy unfire insurance or unaccident insurance. You buy it for what is going to happen. And we want to focus on what we really want to happen, and that is reemployment. So you can see that we would be asking the legislature to put that name change in there. And we want to make sure that you know it would not be and is not a name change only. It does require then that we work with people to help them get back to work quickly. But it also then tells them that when they come in to apply, we're not just asking them to apply or providing information for them to apply for unemployment insurance. There is a requirement that they be able, available, and actively seeking work as well. As part of the legislation, we would say that the reemployment insurance program has 5 goals, and you can see that on page 1 and 2 of the bill, and I would just like to draw your attention to that. Reemployment insurance would be there to provide wage replacement in the form of reemployment insurance benefits to eligible unemployed workers. It would be there to enhance state and local economic stability by partially offsetting the loss of wages to the unemployed and by softening the impact on communities. Many of you who have worked with me before, you've seen maps where you will see what happens to communities when there is large amount of unemployment, that it is a stabilizer for communities. It's not just for the individuals. And then it would also help maintain skills of the labor force to maintain a stable and experienced source of labor for employers. There's a very big concern that employees sometimes move to other places or they do not have skills. And as I said, these kind of go together, that we're trying to increase the skills of Oregon's workforce. It would also highlight work search provisions that are designed to match job seekers with available jobs. We use employment service for that. That's where employers list job orders with us, and then we match based on skills. It would encourage skill and wage gains of eligible workers by payment of reemployment insurance while eligible workers are attending apprenticeship, training, and educational programs, which we've been discussing earlier. And to receive reemployment insurance and to help address particular skill needs in the economy, federal law requires that a claimant be able to work and available for work. And the state of Oregon also requires that the claimant be actively seeking work. And I want to raise that to your attention. Federal law, to be in conformity with federal law, the person only has to be able to work and available work. In Oregon, we have required for some time, but we want to reemphasize that they have to be actively seeking work, and that we would be putting more implicit in the intent of the program. So in number five, the intent of the Oregon Reemployment Insurance would be to recognize and to address the needs of Oregon employers who have jobs requiring qualified workers and the needs of claimants who are actively seeking suitable work. So I hope that you will support us in this effort to not just rename it, but actually get to the attention of the people who will be seeking work that there are reemployment tools and that their wage replacement is to help them look for work.
Questions? Thank you very much. Everybody's ready to call today.
What's your committee deal?
We did it before you got here. We were sitting around doing nothing. Thank you, Verlena, and your entire staff for coming.
Today. You did a great job.
Anybody else that wants to testify on any of these bills that we went through today? I don't think there's anyone left in the room except for employment department staff. Oh, Grover's here, I guess. Did you come to want to testify? Close the public hearing. Anything else for the committee?